But our results clearly show that people become less risk averse. This is an important thing because risk-taking behavior is associated with a lot of things in real life.
Do smart people play chess, or does playing chess make people smart? Relatedly, can teaching children how to play chess improve their educational attainment? The general answer to the latter question seems to be a no. An investigation to test the effects of chess instruction on the academic skills of nearly 4,000 British children showed no effect on their scores in mathematics, literacy, or science. However, a study with Bangladeshi rural primary kids showed an improvement in their calculative risk-taking. So, perhaps playing chess does make people smarter, just not the way we think. In this episode, we turn to Asadul Islam, an economics professor at Monash University, for an answer to this question. Welcome to Banglanomics, a podcast series to propagate economics research for the masses and students of economics with a focus on Bangladesh.
Thank you for joining us today, Professor Asad. It is fantastic to have you here, and I'm really happy that you agreed to be a part of this podcast series. Before we jump into the paper, I just wanted to quickly ask you, what motivated you and encouraged you to pursue an academic career in economics? Because you have a very interesting story.
Thank you, Adnan, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Well, I never thought that I would become an economist. I grew up in a rural area. I spent my childhood going to a school where you cannot imagine these days because the roads were muddy. I had to walk down 2-3 kilometers to go to school every day. There was no other communication in terms of road infrastructure. And my parents never went to school. And I grew up in a large family with 9 brothers and sisters. So it's a rural poor family. A child grew up from there and then came to this point. But when I went to university, Dhaka University, I saw some of my teachers coming from Harvard, from many other places, and they were the inspiration. Initially, I thought that I would go and become a BCS graduate. And then it turned out that I didn't want to be there anymore because I saw one of my teachers who came from Harvard at the time and was teaching us in the first year. And I was very much inspired by his teaching style. And he encouraged us to go abroad. If you can do well, you should go abroad rather than looking for a job in Bangladesh or even going for public service. So that was kind of initial motivation. And then I started doing well. Initially, I didn't have enough confidence that I would do that well. But after first year and second year, I started to realize that I think I am good. I can do well. So in Dhaka University, in the Department of Economics, which is one of the premier institutions in Bangladesh, economics students are considered generally the brightest. I felt more confident that I could do better and better. And that's how I started working harder and harder. And I ended up here.
Thank you so much, Asad Bhai, because your work has been a major inspiration throughout my PhD journey. Thank you for all that you're doing. You're right now the director of the Center for Development Economics and Sustainability at Monash. So I was wondering if you could give like a brief synopsis about what you guys do at CDS and what's the purpose.
I am a passionate researcher. My research is focusing on the underprivileged people. People I see every day in my daily life. Even I'm staying here, I always think about those people and where I grew up. And I try to see whether I can, through my profession, can help develop the skills of these people. So my whole objective is to try to help and make impact. And Center for Development Economics and Sustainability is a kind of organization where we not only do the research, we want to make the research impactful and make it policy relevant research. as the director of the center, I find that I can actually command a lot of resources to do the center activities in this area. So I don't only do myself, I also encourage other colleagues in my center to do research that particularly help poor people in developing countries, both directly through the intervention that we design and try to evaluate, and indirectly in terms of the results and dissemination of the results to the policymakers, NGOs, and practitioners. And hopefully they will take up some evidence-based results and try to scale it up at a wider level.
That's, I think, a perfect segue into the paper, because in the paper, you go back to your village school where you actually run the experiment. So the paper is titled "The Effect of Chess Instruction on Academic and Non-Cognitive Outcomes, Field Experimental Evidence from a Developing Country." What was the prime motivator behind the study? Why did you choose to teach chess instruction and explore its effects among rural kids from primary school? So these are like 10-year-old kids, if I understand.
Yeah, so there are many reasons to focus on it. It's a very popular game. It's easy to play. And the chess board is less costly to buy. There are also general perception among parents and among the general public. If you play chess, you are smart. But this could be that, you know, the smart people are playing the chess. So it's not clear whether it just makes you smart or whether the smart people are playing chess. So there is no study checking actually this causal effect of the chess on different level of outcome, like both cognitive outcomes and also a range of other outcomes that we will probably talk about, including the risk preferences that we find is significant. So that was initial the motivation to try to understand, does it really help the children's both academic and non-academic outcomes? And whether this popular perception for which, you know, in some other countries like Poland and even in some parts in India, Gujarat, and I think probably Andhra Pradesh or Tamil Nadu, they have chess in the school system. In developed countries, chess is used as a kind of extracurricular activities. In my son's school, they play chess before or after school. It's not within their curriculum, but it's suggested from the school that it's a good thing for children. So we wanted to try to see whether we can claim very clearly that, okay, chess can help in this dimension. That's why we tried to look at a whole range of outcomes.
Asad Bhai, on that, could you give an example of how there might be a transfer of learning from playing chess to other domains, might be cognitive or non-cognitive, just so that it's clear and in terms of how it might really happen, what the pathway might be?
Chess involves a lot of calculation, and in terms of sacrifice, it involves a lot of risk calculation. And sometimes you also have to have patience. You just don't jump on and try to kill some of the powers of your opponent, because that might hurt you down the road. So strategic thinking is also important. Whether you can think strategically or whether you can use your calculated risk in terms of your actual behavior in real life, it can potentially teach you many other dimensions. So reward, risk, and other things are involved in chess that can potentially help.
The fieldwork must have been a very exciting time, going back and then teaching chess to these kids. So I was curious in terms of how you felt when you went back for the fieldwork. Is there any exciting or fun story during the fieldwork that you want to share?
We first piloted this project in my own primary school to try to understand how the kids will actually behave. Most of the children were not exposed to playing chess. And so good thing in our case is if you want to examine the effect of chess instruction, this is an ideal setting. It was interesting to see how they react, and they were very enthusiastic. In fact, when we went after a year, a lot of them actually kept their chessboard that we gave to them, and they kept playing themselves with their friends and other family members. So rather than having any short-term effects, so it can have potentially a longer-term effect.
That takes us right into the next question, which is the experiment itself. I thought the experiment was brilliant. It was a very subtle way to encourage students in terms of their learning. So if you could explain the experiment and how it was set up, Asad Bhai for the audience, that'll be great at this point.
The issue is we needed to design our study in a way where we can say clearly that chess has this effect. And if you want to do that, the clearest way is to randomize the students into the chess playing setting and some students randomly excluded from the chess playing setting. But because if you are introducing it in a school, then other children might also be playing, even though you don't actually invite them. So what we needed to do is we had to do this randomization at the school level. So any student in that school who is playing would be considered as a treatment school, even though not all students participated in our experiment. So we had half of the schools which are under treatment and half which are under control. In total, we had 400 students, roughly half and half divided into treatment and control schools. But we only had 16 schools divided equally into 8 treatment and 8 control schools. Among those 8 treatment schools, we targeted the grade 5 students. So our sample, in a way, was limited, partly because we were not initially sure whether chess will have impact. This can be seen as a kind of pilot study. This study is less powered, what we say in economics, but still we see some impacts.
Asad Bhai, related to the randomized control trial, since some of the audience will be watching this are not familiar with the idea of identification and counterfactuals, I was wondering if you could quickly explain that.
Take an example of microcredit. We want to see the impact of microcredit. The issue is some women who are taking credit might perceive the benefits from taking microcredit is high, and they might be more entrepreneurial, they might be more risk-taking, and that's why they are borrowing. Some others who probably are not that much entrepreneurial will not take the microcredit. So there is this selection going on. As a researcher, we do not observe all the characteristics of these women that determine whether some women are actually taking the microcredit or others are not. So this whole range of things, like even this risk-taking behavior, the confidence, it could be your financial knowledge, which is hard to measure. All these things could be important. Or it could be like your mother-in-law or might be encouraging you or discouraging you, and that's why you are not taking or taking the loan, actually. So how do we try to isolate these effects to make sure that these effects, what we call confounder, do not dominate the results or do not determine the results? And if they determine the results, then you cannot really attribute that is due to the microcredit or not. So that's why we in economics developed a lot of techniques to deal with this kind of selection bias problem. To deal with this, the best approach is to do randomized controlled trial. In other words, you offer credit to certain villages. Some women will still be willing to take credit. Others might not be willing to take credit. That's fine. But the offer that you made, if you made offer to, let's say, 1,000 women, let's say only 400 women takes the credit, 600 doesn't take the credit. That's fine. And then you randomly exclude another 1,000 women from a different set of villages who do not interact with these women. Then you can compare this 1,000 women who were offered treatment and 1,000 women who did not get any chance to participate in the microcredit. Any difference that you observe between this 1,000 women who were offered the microcredit and the 1,000 women who were excluded from taking the microcredit, the difference will tell you the impact of microcredit. Remember here, we are not talking about 400 women who took up the credit, because those 400 are self-selected. So you have to compare all the women who were offered versus all the women who were not offered. And then you take the difference in outcome after a year or two when the microcredit has enough cycle in terms of return and other things. And then you compare the outcome and you can see whether their savings have increased, whether their income has gone up, or whether consumption has changed. All these indicators will give you an idea whether the treatment group is better than the control group. You might be interested to measure what happened to this 400 women who actually got the credit. there is approach that women only could get access to the credit because they were offered. And that's why you could use this your offer as a kind of what we in economics call as an instrument to participate in that program. If the offer was not there, you would never have opportunity to participate in the program. So it's randomly offered, and that's why you could find the effect, what we call the treatment effect on treated, the treatment effect on those 400 women. And you can clearly measure the treatment effect on those who received the treatment. And then you can also clearly measure treatment effect of offering credit to 1,000 women. And for a policymakers, both are important. Policymakers want to know, hey, what could we do to these women if we offer everybody in these villages, what will be the impact at the village level? So at the village level, you can just compare that 1,000 women. And if you are interested to know, I want to check how these women who are taking the microcredit are performing, then you just use that 400 women and use that instrument variable approach to try to estimate the treatment effect on those who receive the treatment.
Thank you so much, Asadai. That's beautifully explained. So in this paper, the randomization purpose was exactly that, to be able to isolate the effect of learning chess as opposed to having an inclination towards playing chess and get rid of that selection bias. I'll move on to the outcome variables now. So one of the outcomes was obviously the math scores from the PSC exams, but there were also outcomes of risk preference as well as time preference. And I thought those results were very interesting. Could you briefly explain what do they represent, the risk preference and the time preference, as well as how they were really measured?
Yeah, so I mean, the simplest way to measure the risk preference is you can ask them some stated preferences and try to see what they actually take up, whether they participate in a risky event or not. But anything that is not incentivized, we questioned that, okay, they just didn't take it seriously. In our case, everything was incentivized. So any higher risk was associated with higher reward. But there is also a chance that you might lose. So you have a sure payment. Let's say you get two pencils. And then if you play in a risky game, then there is a chance that you might get four pencils. But there is also a chance that you might get nothing. So there is 50-50 chance. The expected outcome is like two pencils, right? 50% chance of getting nothing, 50% chance of getting four. Sometimes we increase the reward to try to see whether they are risk averse. If, say, we give six pencils instead of four, but again, 50% chance of getting six and 50% chance of getting zero, then you know the expected payoff is higher here. So if you are risk neutral, you will be taking the two pencils. But if you are risk averse, now in this case, you might be thinking about, oh, I can potentially get six pencil and expected payoff is three. Instead of if you had a four versus zero, then as a risk averse individual, you will definitely choose the one with two because that's a sure outcome. And why would you take risky gamble? So that's how we actually designed the risk preferences. For students, we gave them some chocolate, some pencils that they use it and they like to have it so that it is attractive to them. Also for us, it was not that costly as well. So time preference, we also had a similar way to design. You ask them, do you want this today, two pencils versus tomorrow? If you get it, you get three pencils. Some students are impatient, they want today two pencils. But then we check the patience level, we increase the reward. So how about you get four pencils tomorrow instead of two, and five, and six, and so on, and see when they switch. At some point, they might switch because, you know, the reward is so high tomorrow, I will just wait another day to get that. So that's the time preference can be measured. Okay, there are different other ways to measure the preference, but this is the simplest way.
So what do you guys find? What are the main findings of the study, both in terms of the math scores, risk, time preferences, as well as other outcomes? And how far into the future are they really sustained?
We see after almost a year of our intervention, the children who played chess were less risk averse. That means they are more willing to take risk. we also see some gains in terms of the improvement in math score. Again, as I said in the beginning, because our sample size is limited, if we follow some strong statistical criteria, then our results on math score or time preference and other things do not hold strongly. But our results clearly show that people become less risk averse. This is an important thing because risk-taking behavior is associated with a lot of things in real life. Whether you want to take science or arts in your grade 9 or 10 is also sometimes we think about risk-taking behavior. Independent of your cognitive abilities, some students, they might think that, okay, science is too difficult for me. I don't want to go and compete with a lot of smart students and things like that. So risk-taking competition, these are all correlated. We do see a risk-taking behavior improve. And this has clear link with the game because the game involves directly planning and also taking calculated risk. If you want to win, you might have to lose certain pawns or certain things to win the game because you develop these skills and it's a calculated risk. You have to take risk in a more calculated way. And that's what we find that this is happening.
So it seems like the kids developed the skill over time, which led to the fall in risk aversion. So I thought that was very interesting, and I was wanting to know your insights about that.
We don't definitely have clear answer because our randomization was not done in a way that we can say whether it's due to playing longer term. But the evidence and finding that we have tend to suggest that a lot of children keep playing chess among themselves. Over 3 weeks period, we gave them lessons and we measured their short-term outcome. And then after 10 months of completing the intervention, we measured their longer-term outcome. So because over this 10 months period, they kept playing and they probably developed new way of taking risks. So those kind of things probably develop over time. These things can be nurtured. So we might not see immediately after any intervention is completed, but the intervention can have a persistent effect. And especially in this case, children kept playing and that has a longer term effects. I cannot say this is really the case, but this all the evidence that we have tend to suggest that this probably is the most plausible scenario.
The other part of the findings that I thought was interesting is that there was no effect on attention or focus or creativity. And I was wondering why. Creativity, I kind of understand, but the attention and the focus, because you do need to be focused while playing chess. And it's curious that there was no effect.
Yeah, no, thanks. This is an important point. Again, I don't know whether we can conclude anything. Definitely, we did not find any significant effect. But whether chess has any effect cannot be concluded from our study on this dimension because one issue is the sample size. And then another thing is the measuring attention creativity is not really easy. There are certain dimensions of creativity that can be developed through chess. Creativity has a whole range of things. If you say that, okay, I'm a very good artist, chess will not teach you to become a good artist. That's a different creative thing. But chess has probably certain effect on some aspects of creativity. One problem probably we had is to find out that particular segment and how we detect that effect. One is the measurement of creativity, attention, focus, and things. And this is completely new in the economics literature. We try to borrow from psychology literature. They have probably other domain. And so I would think that you know, the measurement needs to be carefully examined. And the second thing is our study has given us a kind of food for thought in terms of what to think about and why we did not find these effects. People who are listening, I hope someone here in Bangladesh or in some other parts of the world will take it up and examine these effects of chess on other outcomes.
So Asif, I wanted to ask you, if there was one major policy suggestion that you would want to make to policymakers of Bangladesh based on the paper, would this be your suggestion to introduce playing chess at primary schools in Bangladesh, or would it be something else?
I don't want to prescribe that everybody should play chess. But at the same time, our results say that chess has a potential positive effects. It seems to me that if government wants to introduce any extracurricular activities in education settings, this is probably the most easy, feasible way to do things because you want them to also be interested. It involves competition. It involves some fun, excitement after win. And also, if you lose, they still keep thinking how they can win the next game. I would say that this is an approach government or policymakers should think seriously. In the developed country context, there is so many things going on in the education settings, in the early childhood development, stimulation in terms of playing different games. Every kid in kindergarten and the primary school, they play puzzles, games, a lot of games. We don't have that in Bangladesh, especially in rural area. So, giving these students is kind of stimulus. And I would say that we should introduce it even early. It's a kind of a way to develop their patience, concentration, the risk-taking behavior. And my hunch is if we can do it over a long period of time for a student, it will develop many other skills.
Thank you. I'm going to call this Asad Bhai's Queen's Gambit. Okay, final question to you, Asad Bhai. What advice would you give to budding economists, students who are studying economics right now, want to pursue it further into their master's and PhD, and maybe in the research track? What advice would you give to these young people?
Your passion and your hard work. That's the key thing. Most of the students who come at the graduate level, they have the ability. We can say that, some students are very smarter than others. There are, and I probably belong to other category. I was not a smart at all. In fact, in my primary school, I used to be probably the last boy in my class. I was known as the brother of my elder brother because my elder brother used to be the first boy in the class, and I used to be the last. Even in my high school, I was not first boy in my high school. So I tried to develop over time, and it happened over time. But I still say to these people that I am not that creative. I am not really that smart. I just work hard, and I just have passion. That's how I am here today. Anything that happened, of course, you need a certain bit of luck and some other elements. Look for the opportunity where you think your skill will match. Don't just jump on any tough school. Most often we have this kind of impression that, if we go to top school, then that's it. Completion of your PhD is the start of your career, start of your life. So think about where you will go and benefit from. Not all places will give you access and scope to the kind of ability that you have. As I say, if you go to an institution where you will find that you are in the bottom 10th percentile, then you will probably end up losing rather than going to an institution where you will be reasonably okay and can actually confidently deal with your classmate or talk to potential supervisors and get some good research done. Because your certificate is not the key. The key is mainly, the research that you will be producing. So make sure that you have that kind of foresight. You should have ambition. Everybody should have ambition. But don't shoot up too much high where you might get frustrated. So check your ability, jump a bit, and then recalculate, and then again go and do more. Yes, you need to push the boundary, work harder, and have your commitment. Then you will be able to do better.
Thank you so much for being here today, Asad Bhai, and I look forward to spending more time with you and hopefully seeing you in person sometime this year or next.
Thank you, and come and visit us in this part. You are now far away, but hopefully we'll see you back in Australia.